From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Tony by William Relling. They found what was left of the night nurse, the pretty one named Teresa, stuffed in a linen closet near the tub room on the second floor. She wasn't very pretty when they found her. One of the housekeepers opened the door and saw her first, and she screamed and screamed. They let her go home early for the day. Judy, the head nurse on the day shift, called the police. A couple of orderlies took Teresa's body down to the hospital morgue on a stretcher, covered with a white sheet that they brought with them. They couldn't use any of the ones from the closet where they found Teresa. They were all red and sticky. The orderlies didn't take her body away until after the first policemen came, the ones who wore uniforms. The policemen who came later wore suits and ties. One of them had a camera, and another had something that looked kind of like a fishing tackle box. He took out some kind of powder and they brushed it around the closet. He was looking for fingerprints, just like they do on television. Another one was with Dr. Woodburn when he came to do his rounds. The policeman went into the conference room with Dr. Woodburn after the doctor had stopped off at the nurse's station and got all of his patients' charts. I didn't find out that the man with Dr. Woodburn was a policeman until later. Dr. Woodburn called me into conference after he had talked to Lila. I sat down in the same seat as always. Dr. Woodburn sat in his seat at the other end of the table. The policeman was sitting next to him. I pulled an ashtray over next to me and lit a cigarette. "Are you feeling all right today, John?" asked Dr. Woodburn. He had my chart open in front of him. "Not so bad now," I said. He paged through my chart. Then he looked at me and he made a noise like he was clearing his throat. "John," Dr. Woodburn said, "this man is a police detective, a homicide detective. I think it will be all right if he asks you some questions." I sort of smiled and nodded to them. "My name is Sergeant Stevens," said the policeman. "How do you do?" I said. "I'm fine," he answered. He had a funny look on his face like he wasn't sure what to say to me. "You don't have to be afraid to talk to me, Sergeant," I said. "I know where I am and why I'm here. And I don't rant or rave or hit myself or make trouble. And I know why you're here, too." He looked at Dr. Woodburn. "He didn't tell me anything," I went on. "We all know. And I'm not stupid. I'm just crazy." Sergeant Stephen got that funny look again. "Mr. Garbo knows what he's saying, Sergeant," Dr. Woodburn said softly. The policeman took a deep breath. "Okay, Mr. Garbo," he said to me. "You know about Nurse Caputo?" I nodded. "Did you know her personally?" he asked. "Sure," I answered. "She's been here for almost a year." Sergeant Stevens looked surprised. "You've been here that long?" I laughed. "Of course not," I said, "at least not this time. But I've been here before. They do allow us to talk to the nurses, Sergeant, even at night." "John," Dr. Woodburn warned me. "Sorry," I said. I turned back to Sergeant Stevens. "Yes, I knew Teresa." "Did you know her very well?" I shrugged. "As well as any of the rest of the staff, I suppose. She was a pleasant enough person, not really any different from anybody else." "Did you like her?" "We weren't friends, Sergeant, if that's what you mean. I'm a patient, she's a nurse, she had her job." I smiled again, "and I have mine." He was writing in a brown notebook that he pulled from one of the pockets in his suit coat. "Is there anything else you can tell me about last night?" he asked. "Like what?" "Like, did you see anything or did you hear anything?" "You mean out of the ordinary?" I cut in. I was smiling again. "You know, Sergeant," I said, "this is really a lot more like television than I thought it would be." "Did you see anything, Mr. Garbo?" he asked. I crushed my cigarette in the ashtray. "Answer him, please, John," said Dr. Woodburn. "All right," I said, giving in. I was angry with him. "There was nothing unusual about last night. Lila had a fit because she was outvoted and didn't get to watch Happy Days. And my brother Rod and his wife came to see me, but they left about 8:30. I went to my room and I read about till 11 o'clock and then I fell asleep. I woke up when I heard Mrs. Thompson screaming, which was about 6 this morning. They made us all stay in our rooms and we didn't get breakfast until after 8. My cereal was soggy." I pointed at his notebook. "Be sure you get that down, Sergeant," I said. "I want to register a complaint." He frowned at me and closed the notebook. "Thank you, Mr. Garbo," he said. He wasn't happy. "That's all, John," Mr. Woodburn said, dismissing me. "Wait a minute," I said. "That's all? You're not going to talk to me, Doctor?" "Not today." "Now, just hold on." I paused. They were looking at me sternly. They wanted me to leave. I looked out the ashtray. "I know who killed Teresa," I said. "I didn't hear you, John," said Dr. Woodburn. "I said I know who killed Teresa, damn it!" I slammed a fist on the table. They both jumped. The policeman looked from Dr. Woodburn to me, then back to Dr. Woodburn again. I thought for a minute that he looked scared. I shook my head. "I'm sorry." "It's all right, John," said Dr. Woodburn. "Do you, Sergeant?" Stevens asked me. "Do you know who killed Miss Caputo?" I lit another cigarette. Neither of them saw my hand shaking. I made it stop before they could see it. "Yes, Sergeant," I said calmly. "I know." "Who?" he asked. He was leaning way forward over the table. I looked to Dr. Woodburn. "Do you know something, John?" he asked me. The policeman was staring hard at me. He began to push himself up out of his chair, but Dr. Woodburn put a hand on his arm to stop him. He shook it off and stood up. "Mr. Garbo," said the policeman, in a voice that was very official, "you didn't see Miss Caputo's body, did you? But you knew her. Do you want to know how she looked when we found her?" Mr. Woodburn said, "Hold on, Sergeant." The policeman snapped at him. "No, Doctor. If he knows something, then I want to know." Sergeant Stevens turned to me again. "An animal killed her, Mr. Garbo," he said. "She was ripped to pieces." I was still calm. "An animal?" I said. "That's right. Now, I don't know anything more than you, than what your doctor told me before you came in." "Paranoid schizophrenia," I said helpfully. His eyes flashed angrily. "I don't care about that," he shouted. "But I don't think that you're too crazy to understand that everybody here is in danger until we catch Teresa Caputo's killers." "Touchy, Sergeant," I said. He demanded, "If you know something about this maniac..." Dr. Woodburn grabbed the policeman by the arm. "That's enough, Sergeant," he said harshly. "This is a psychiatric unit, and John is a patient. He's not a criminal. I'd appreciate it if you would keep that in mind." The policeman fell back into his chair. "I apologize, Mr. Garbo," he said. Dr. Woodburn looked down the table at me. "Do you know something, John?" he asked quietly. I was looking down at the ashtray again. "I know," I said. Dr. Woodburn said, "I can't hear you when you mumble." "I said, I know." The policeman leaned forward. "You know who killed her?" I nodded. "Yes, I know. He told me." "Who told you?" "Tony." "Tony who?" He surprised me that he was so stupid. Tony, I said. "How many Tonys are there here?" The policeman turned to Dr. Woodburn and questioned the doctor with his eyes. Dr. Woodburn shrugged. "I don't have any patients named Tony in the unit," he said. "A woman's name, maybe?" "Perhaps," said Dr. Woodburn. He got up out of his chair. "It may be another patient belonging to another doctor. I can check the register at the nurse's station." On his way out of the conference room, Dr. Woodburn paused when he reached my chair. "Help him," Johnny whispered. "Tell him what you know." Dr. Woodburn walked out of the room and closed the door behind him. I was turned around in my chair, looking at the door. "Tony who?" the policeman said to my back. I spun around. He was glaring at me. "Tony who?" he repeated. I shook my head. "You know, Sergeant," I said, "you're not as smart as I first thought you were." He came out of his chair. "Listen to me," he spat angrily. "If you're just screwing around with me, I don't give a damn if you're supposed to be sick or not. But you know something, and you're going to tell me." He was shaking a finger at me, and his eyes were popping. I thought that his face would explode. "I told you already," I said. "Tony!" His face was bright red with rage. "Tony who?" I gave him as hard a look as I could manage. "You're so stupid," I said. That's when he slapped me. Like last night, in the middle of the night, when Teresa slapped me. When all I wanted to do was touch her, and she slapped me and called me an animal. So Tony killed her, like an animal. The conference room was soundproof, but that didn't matter. Tony never gave Sergeant Stevens a chance to scream. Dr. Woodburn was the first one in there. The other policemen were still in the unit, and the doctor called them in right away. Sergeant Stevens lay on the table. His head hung over the edge, right at the point where his throat had been chewed open after he had been strangled. His throat was gaping, and the air from his windpipe made the blood bubble over his suit. His eyes were open. Then they saw me. I was sitting in Dr. Woodburn's chair. I smiled at them. They were staring at my face. I wiped my mouth with the back of my hand, then looked down at it. My hand was bloody. I smiled again. I told them it was an animal. Just like Sergeant Stevens said, it was Tony. Like in Tony the Tiger, you know, great. Then I growled. Stoner by William F. Nolan. The thing is, thought Stoner, I shouldn't have gone into this lousy wax museum. That's for damn sure. Plenty to see here in Frisco without me buying a ticket and going into this frigging museum of corpses. I mean, said Stoner to Stoner, that's what they look like, right? Like dead people standing there staring at you with those glassy, dead eyes of theirs. It was a rainy Tuesday late in the afternoon, and Stoner was alone in the place. The heavy-lidded ticket taker hardly blinked when he took Stoner's money. Looked like a big fat frog to Stoner. Ought to be out in some pond sitting on a lily pod or whatever the hell frogs sat on in ponds. Stoner was crazy, and it bothered him. Being crazy, but then a lot of things about Stoner bothered Stoner. Always had, ever since he'd been a kid. Fought with himself a lot. When he was walking along the street, Stoner would argue violently with himself in a loud voice. Some people would turn and look at him, but most people ignored Stoner. Most of his life, except when he did really crazy things, Stoner had been ignored. Stoner was used to people moving away from him when he walked toward them while he was scowling and swearing at Stoner. Stoner didn't like dead people. They reminded him he'd maybe be dead someday, and Stoner hated the whole idea of being dead. He swore to himself he wouldn't be. "I'll never be dead," said Stoner, "and that's for damn sure." The museum entrance was at the bottom of a long flight of stairs, and Stoner smelled the rubber matting on the stairs. It smelled like ether in a hospital, or in a morgue. The guard who was supposed to watch people in the museum was snoozing on his high wooden stool, tipped back against the puke-colored wall at the foot of the stairs. Maybe he was dead, too. Friggin' dead guard. "How are things?" a voice asked him as Stoner walked into the museum. It was Stoner's voice. "Not so damn good," said Stoner. "You should maybe have killed that guy today, the one who gave you that write-up from San Diego," said Stoner. "He probably had some cash on him and a watch or a ring you could have hawked." "I don't kill people," said Stoner. "You're nuts." "Hey, we're both nuts," said Stoner. "So what else is new?" "Why don't you just shot your gob?" said Stoner. "Give me some friggin' peace." Smoke? And a dark hand, very tan with lots of hair at the wrist, held out a cigarette. The hands looked like Stoner's. Sometimes, though, it was hard to tell. "Obliged," said Stoner, taking a cigarette. The hand lit it. Stoner inhaled deeply. "Sign says no smoking in here," said Stoner. "Frig the sign." Stoner was walking along a kind of aisle with ropes at both sides. Old velvet ropes smelly of dead cats. Behind the ropes were the wax people staring out at Stoner. He walked up to a buxom young woman, redhead. She had one of those long flouncy gone with the wind kind of dresses with a low-cut front. Stoner liked the low-cut front. He put his hand inside the dress. "Sign says, don't touch him," said Stoner. "So what? So who's to see what I do in here? We're all alone, right?" "Yeah, I guess so." Stoner kept walking. He stopped in front of a bearded guy in a tall stovepipe hat who was standing with his hand on the shoulder of a little black kid in tattered overalls and a checkered shirt. He was Abe Lincoln, the guy with the beard. Stoner reached across the rope and knocked his hat off. "Why'd you do that?" asked Stoner. "'Cause I think it's a friggin' dumb hat is all," said Stoner. "I wouldn't have done it," said Stoner. "You got no respect for the president." "I got no respect for nobody," said Stoner. Stoner kept going and turned a corner into another room. This one spooked Stoner. It was a room where the French Revolution cut people's heads off. There was a young girl with her hands tied behind her back kneeling at the guillotine with her head already off and in a basket. Stoner reached in and picked up the head. "I wouldn't do that," said Stoner. Stoner didn't answer. He tossed the girl's severed head into the air and caught it by its long golden hair. Then he put the head inside his shirt. It made him look pregnant. "They'll never let you take that out of the museum," said Stoner. "Frig what they won't let me do." And he walked into a room full of pirates who were in the middle of a big fight on the deck of a ship. There was a painted ocean around the deck with the paint peeling off the waves. Stoner stepped over the rope and went up to one of the fighting pirates with a patch over his eye and took the guy's sword. "It's probably fake," said Stoner. It wasn't. It was real. And it was sharp. He cut the pirates' heads off with it. "Fake my ass," said Stoner. "You're acting crazy again." That's what crazy people do, right? Act crazy? And Stoner snorted out a laugh. Sometimes you gotta laugh out of things. He walked through the museum cutting off heads. Every wax figure he came to, he cut the head off. Zip, zap, zip, zap, zip, zap. Stoner was having fun. Maybe coming here into this museum wasn't such a lousy idea after all. Which was when the guard showed up, the one who'd been snoozing at the bottom of the stairs. "What the hell's going on?" he yelled at Stoner. "I'm cutting off heads," said Stoner. "You're under arrest, man," said the guard, reaching for the bright gun at his belt. "Frig you," said Stoner, and cut off his head. Zip zap. "I thought you said you didn't kill people," said Stoner. "Up to now, I didn't," Stoner replied. "But he was going to arrest me and put me in a cell, and you know how much we hate being put in cells." "Yeah," nodded Stoner. "Boy, oh boy," said Stoner, sitting on the floor. "I probably made a big mistake cutting off this guy's head." He put down the sword and lit another cigarette. The smoke made his mother's face appear in the air. He didn't like that. "What you gonna do now?" asked Stoner. "I have to think, to plan and figure and work things out." "Hey, you!" It was a froggy ticket taker. It was walking down the aisle towards Stoner. "Closing time," he said. "We're closing up." When he got to Stoner, he stopped and looked down at the dead guard, and then he looked at Stoner. "Jeez," the ticket taker said softly, and he began to back away, his face all green. Stoner had to laugh, because now he really did look like a frog. "Where are you going off to?" asked Stoner. But the froggy little man didn't answer. He turned to run. Stoner finished him. Zip zap. "Okay, boy, you've had it now," said Stoner. "The cops will come in and put you in the gas chamber, or hang you, or put you in the electric chair, or inject you with some kind of killer drug." "I don't think so," said Stoner. "You gonna plead self-defense?" And Stoner chuckled. "I'm insane, right? Just like you are. Insane people do do insane things. That's logic. Stoner shook his head. You never should have bought a ticket to a place like this, he said. I won't argue with you on that one, nodded Stoner. I guess I really screwed up buying a ticket to this lousy place. He took the girl's head out of his shirt and looked at it. She was very pretty. He smoothed the long blonde hair and put the head down, gently next to the dead guard's head. Then he walked back to the French Revolution room and stopped in front of the guillotine. He looked up at the suspended blade. A release cord was hanging down from it. Stoner pushed aside the body of the girl with her hands tied and took her place, kneeling down to put his neck into the wooden groove underneath the blade. Then he jerked the cord. It's probably fake, said Stoner. It wasn't. The Lady of Rosemount by Sir T.G. Jackson. And so, Charlton, you're going to spend part of the long at Rosemount Abbey? I envy you. It's an awfully jolly old place, and you'll have a really good time. Yes, said Charlton, I'm looking forward to it immensely. I've never seen it, you know. It has only lately come to my uncle, and they only moved into it last Christmas. I forgot that you knew it and had been there. Oh, I don't know it very well, said Edwards. I spent a few days there a year or two ago with the last owner. It will suit you down to the ground, for you are mad about old abbeys and ruins, and you'll find enough there to satisfy the whole society of antiquaries as well as yourself. When do you go? Very soon. I must be at home for a week or so after we go down, and then I think my uncle will expect me at Rosemount. What are you going to do? Well, I hardly know. Nothing very exciting. Perhaps take a short run abroad a little later. But I shall have to read part of the long, for I am in for greats next term. By the way, it is just possible I may be somewhere in your direction, or have friends near Rosemount who want me to spend part of the vacation down there. All right, said Charlton. Don't forget to come over and see me. I hope I may still be there. Meanwhile, au revoir, old man, and good luck to you. Charlton remained some time at his window, looking down at the quad of his college. Term at Oxford was just over, and the men were rapidly going down. Hansoms were waiting at the gate. Scouts and messengers were clattering down the staircases with portmanteau and other paraphernalia proper to youth, and piling them on the cabs. Friends were shaking hands and bidding goodbye. In a few hours, the college would be empty, and solitude would descend upon it for 4 months, broken only by occasional visitors, native or transatlantic. The flight of the men would be followed by that of the dons to all parts of Europe or beyond. The hive would be deserted, and the porter would reign supreme over a vast solitude, monarch of all he surveyed. Charlton was not due to go down till the next morning. He dined in the junior common room with 3 or 4 other men, the sole survivors of the crowd, and then retired to his rooms to finish his packing. That done, he sat on the window seat looking into the quad. It was a brilliant night. The moonshine slept on the grass and silvered the gray walls and mullioned windows opposite, while the chapel and hall were plunged in impenetrable shadow. Everything was as still as death. No sound from the outer world penetrated the enclosure, and for the busy hive of men within, there was now the silence of a desert. There is perhaps no place where silence and solitude can be more sensibly felt than the interior of an Oxford college in vacation time, and there was something in the scene that appealed to the temperament of the young man who regarded it. Henry Charlton was an only child. His father had died when he was a lad, and his mother, broken down by grief, had forsworn society and lived a very retired life in the country. At Winchester and Oxford, he naturally mixed with others and made acquaintances, but his home life was somewhat somber and his society restricted. He grew up a self-contained, reserved lad, with few friendships. Those few he formed were sincere, and his attachments were strong. His temperament, poetical and tinged with melancholy, naturally inclined to romance, and from his early youth delighted in antiquarian pursuits, heraldic lore, and legend. At school and college he reveled in the ancient architecture by which he was surrounded. His taste even carried him further into the region of psychic research and the dubious revelations of spiritualism, though a certain wholesome vein of skepticism saved him from plunging deeply into those mazes, whether of truth or imposture, as he sat at his window. The familiar scene put on an air of romance. The silence sank into his soul. The windows where friendly light was wont to shine through red curtains, inviting a visit, were now blind and dark. Mystery enveloped the well-known walls. They seemed a place for the dead, no longer a habitation for living men, of whom he might be the last survivor. At last, rising from his seat and half laughing at his own romantic fancies, Henry Charlton went to bed. A few weeks later, he descended from the train at the little country station of Brick Hill in Northamptonshire, and while the porter was collecting his traps on a handbarrow, he looked out for the carriage that was to meet him. "Hello, Harry, here you are," said a voice behind him, and turning around, he was warmly greeted by his cousin, Charlie Wilmot. A car was waiting into which he and his belongings were packed, and in 5 minutes they were off, bowling along one of the wide Northamptonshire roads, with a generous expanse of green sward on each side between the hedges and the hedgerow timber. The country was new to Henry Charlton, and he looked about him with interest. The estate of Rosemount had lately come unexpectedly by the death of a distant relation to his uncle, Sir Thomas Wilmot, and the family had hardly had time yet to settle down in their new home. His cousin Charlie was full of the novelty of the situation and the charms of the abbey. "I can tell you it's a rattling old place," said he, "full of odd holes and corners, and there are the ruins of the church with all sorts of old things to be seen. But you'll have lots of time to look about and see it all. And here we are, and there's my dad waiting to welcome you at the hall door." They had turned in at a lodge gate and passed up an avenue, at the end of which Henry could see a hoary pile of stone gables, mullioned windows, massive chimneys, and a wide arch portal, hospitably open, where Sir Thomas stood to welcome his nephew. Some years had passed since Henry had seen his relatives, and he was glad to be with them again. A houseful of lively cousins, rather younger than himself, had in former days afforded a welcome change from his own rather melancholy home, and he looked forward with pleasure to renewing the intimacy. His young cousin Charlie was just at the end of his time at Eton, and was to go to university in October. The girls Kate and Sissy had shot up since he used to play with them in the nursery, and they were now too old to be kissed. His uncle and aunt were as kind as ever, and after he had answered their inquiries about his mother and given an account of his uneventful journey down, the whole party adjourned to the garden, where tea awaited them under the trees, and then Henry for the first time saw something of the Abbey of Rosemount. The ancient foundation of Sanctus Egidius and Monte Rosarum had been a Benedictine house, dating from the 12th century, which at the dissolution was granted to a royal favorite, who partly dismantled and partly converted it into a residence for himself. His descendants in the time of James I had pulled down a great part of the conventual buildings and substituted for the inconvenient cells of the monks a more comfortable structure in the style of that day. Many fragments of the abbey, however, were incorporated into the later house. The refectory of the monks was kept, and formed the great hall of the mansion with its vaulted roof and traced windows, in which were even remained some of the old storied glass. The abbot's kitchen still furnished Sir Thomas's hospitable board, and among the offices and elsewhere were embedded parts of the domestic buildings. North of the refectory, according to the usual Benedictine plan, had been the cloister and beyond that the church, which lay at a slightly lower level. The lie of the ground, inclining that way from the summit of the Mount of Roses on which the habitable part of the convent had been built. Of the cloister enough remained, though much broken and dilapidated, to show what it had been, but the greater part of the church was destroyed for the sake of its materials when the Jacobean house was built. A considerable part of the nave, however, was still standing, part of it even with its vaulted roof intact, and of the rest enough of the lower part of the walls was left to show that the church had been of fair size, though not on the scale of the larger establishments. Henry Charlton, with the greedy eyes of the born antiquary, took in the general scheme of the abbey with his tea and buttered toast under the shade of the elms that bounded the lawn on that side of the house. But he had to control his impatience to visit the ruins, for after tea his cousins insisted on a game of tennis, which lasted till it was time to dress for dinner, and after dinner it was too late and too dark for exploration. They dined in the great hall, once the monks' refectory, but not too large for modern comfort, the abbey having been one of the smaller houses of the order, and the number of the brotherhood limited. Henry was enchanted and could not restrain the expression of his enthusiasm. "Ah," said his aunt, "I remember your mother told me you were crazy about architecture and antiquities. Well, you'll have your fill of them here. For my part, I often sigh for a little more modern convenience." "But, my dear aunt," said Henry, "there is so much to make up for little inconveniences in living in this lovely old place that they might be forgotten." "Why, what do you know about housekeeping?" said his aunt. "I should like you to hear Mrs. Baldwin, the housekeeper, on the subject. How she toils up one staircase only to have to go down another. The house, she says, is made up of stairs that are not wanted, and crooked passages that might have been straight, and it took the maids a fortnight to learn their ways to the food store." "It's of no use, mother," said Charlie. "You'll never convince him. He would like to have those old monks back again, and to be one of them himself, with a greasy cowl on his head and sandals on his naked feet, and nothing to eat but herbs washed down with water." "No, no," said Henry, laughing. "I don't want them back, for I like my present company too well. But I confess I like to call up in imagination the men who built and lived in these old walls. I believe I shall dream of them tonight." "Well, Harry," said his uncle, "you may dream of them as much as you please, so long as you don't bring them back to turn us out. And you shall have every opportunity, for you are to sleep in a bit of the old convent that the abbey builders of the modern house spared. And who knows, but that the ghost of its former occupant may not take you at your word, and come back to revisit his old quarters." Harry laughed as they rose from table, and said he trusted his visitor would not treat him as an intruder. The long summer day had enabled them to finish dinner by daylight, and there was still light enough for the old painted glass to be seen. It was very fragmentary, and not one of the pictures was perfect. In one of the lights they could make out part of a female figure richly dressed. She had been holding something that was broken away, and beside her was a lower half of an unmistakable demon with hairy legs and cloven hoof. The legend below ran thus, the last words being imperfect: "Qui Walter di Bavis tentavit, comitessam ali." The legs light was still more imperfect, but there was a part of the same female figure in violent action with the fragment of a legend: "Hic Comtissa tentata adi." Other parts, evidently the same story, remained in the next window, but they were too fragmentary to be understood. In one light was a piece of a monk's figure and a part of a legend: "Hic frater Pavlis dat comi." The last of all was tolerably perfect. It represented a female robed in black and holding in her hand a little model of a church. She was on her knees prostrate before the Pope, who was seated and extended his hand in the act of benediction. The legend below said, "Hic comitissa a papa absolta est." Henry was much interested and wanted to know the story of the sinful countess, but none of the party could tell him, and indeed none of them had till then paid much attention to the glass. Sir Thomas had once made a slight attempt to trace the identity of the countess, but with little success, and had soon given up the search. "There's an antiquarian problem for you to solve, Harry," said he, "but I don't know where you should look for the solution. The annals of Rosemont are very imperfect, and those within my reach, I could find nothing bearing on the subject." "I'm afraid, sir," said Harry, "if you failed, I am not likely to succeed, for I am only a very humble antiquary, and should not know where to begin. It seems to me, however, that the story must have something to do with the history of the abbey, and that its fortunes were connected with the wicked countess, or the monks would not have put her story in their windows." "Well, then, there you have a clue to follow up," said his uncle, "and now let us join the ladies." The room where Henry Charlton was to sleep was on the ground floor in one corner of the house, and looked out upon the cloister and the ruined abbey church. It was, as his uncle had said, a relic of the domestic part of the abbey, and when he had parted with his cousin Charlie, who guided him thither, he looked around the apartment with the keenest interest. It was a fair-sized room, low-pitched, with a ceiling of massive black timbers, plastered between the joists. The walls were so thick that there was room for a little seat in the window recess on either side, which was reached by a step, for the window sill was rather high above the floor. Opposite the window yawned a wide fireplace with dogs for wood logs and a heap of wood ashes lying on the hearth. The walls were paneled with oak up to the ceiling, and the floor, where not covered with rugs, was of the same material polished brightly. But for the toilet appliances of modern civilization, the room was unaltered from the time when the last brother of the convent left it, never to return. Harry tried to picture to himself his predecessor in the apartment. He imagined him sitting at the table, reading or writing, or on his knees in prayer. On his simple shelf would have been his few books and manuscripts, borrowed from the convent library, to which he had to return them when they met in chapter once a year, under severe penalty in case of loss or damage. As he lay on his bed, Henry tried to imagine what his own thoughts would have been had he himself been that ghostly personage 5 centuries ago. He fancied himself in the choir of the great church. He heard the sonorous Gregorian chanting by a score of deep, manly voices, ringing in the vaulted roof and echoing through the aisles. He saw the embroidered vestments, the lights that shone clearer and brighter as the shades of evening wrapped arcade and triforium in gloom and mystery, and turned to blackness the storied windows that lately gleamed with the hues of the sapphire, the ruby, and the emerald. Pleased with these fancies, he lay awake till the clock struck 12, and then insensibly the vision faded, and he fell asleep. His sleep was not untroubled. Several times he half woke, only to drop off again, and resume the thread of a tiresome dream that puzzled and worried him, but led to no conclusion. When morning came, he awoke in earnest, and tried to piece together the fragments he could remember, but made little of them. He seemed to have seen the monk sitting at the table as he had pictured him in imagination the evening before. The monk was not reading, but turning over some little bottles, which he took from a leather case, and he seemed to be waiting for someone or something. Then Henry in his dream fancied that someone did come and something did happen, but what it was he could not remember, and of the visitor he could recall nothing, except that he felt there was a personality present, but not so as to be seen and recognized, more an impression than a fact. He could remember, however, a hand stretched out toward the seated figure and the objects he was handling. More than this he could not distinctly recall, but the same figures recurred each time he fell asleep, with slightly varied attitude, though with no great distinctness. For the monk he could account by the thoughts he had been in his mind the night before, but for the incident in his dream, if so vague a matter could be called an incident, he could trace no suggestion in his own mind. The bright summer morning and the merry party at breakfast soon drove the memory of the dream out of his head. After breakfast there were the horses and dogs to be seen, and the garden to be visited, and it was not till the afternoon that his cousins let him satisfy his longing to visit the ruins of the church and cloister. There they all went in a body. The cloister lawn was mown smoothly and well tended, and here and there barely rising above the green sward were the stones that marked the resting places of the brotherhood. Part of the cloister retained its traceried windows and vaulted roof, and on the walls were inscribed the names of abbots and monks whose bones lay beneath the pavement. At the end of the western walk, a finely sculptured door led into the nave of the church, the oldest part of the building, built when the ruder Norman work was just melting into greater refinement. Henry was in raptures and vowed that neither fountains nor revolt could show anything more perfect. The girls were delighted to find their favorite parts of the building appreciated and led him from point to point, determined that he should miss nothing. "And now," said Sissy, "you have to see the best bit of all, hasn't he, Kate? We don't show it to everybody for fear strangers might do mischief." So saying, she pushed open a door in the side wall and led them into a chapel built out between two of the great buttresses of the nave aisle. It was indeed a gem of architecture of the purest 14th-century Gothic, and Henry stood entranced before its loveliness. The delicate traceries on wall and roof were carved with a finish of ivory, and though somewhat stained by weather, for the window had lost their glass, had kept other sharp precision. Part of the outer wall had given way, weeds and ivy had invaded and partly covered the floor and a thick mass of vegetation while it was piled up under the windows against the masonry. "What a pity to let this place get into such a mess," said Henry. "I've never seen anything more beautiful." "Well," said Charlie, "it wouldn't take long to clear all this rubbish away. Suppose we set to work, and we do it." So while the girls sat and looked on, the two men fetched some garden tools and cut, hacked, and pulled up the weeds and ivy and brambles, which they threw out by the beach in the wall, and soon made a partial clearance. Henry had begun on the mass that stood breast high next to the window, when a sudden exclamation made the others look at him. He was peering down into the mass of vegetation, of which he had removed the top layer, with an expression of amazement that drew the others to his side. Looking up at them out of the mass of ivy was a face, the face of a beautiful woman, her hair disposed in graceful masses and bound by a slender coronet. It was evident that under the pile of vegetation was a tomb with an effigy that had long been hidden, and the very existence of which had been forgotten. When the rest of the vegetation had been cleared away, there appeared an altar tomb on the top of which lay the alabaster figure of a woman. The sides bore escutcheons of heraldry, and had evidently once been colored. The figure was exquisitely modeled, the work of no mean sculptor. The hands were crossed on the breast, and the drapery magnificently composed. But with the head of the figure, the artist had surpassed himself. It was a triumph of sculpture. The features were of perfect beauty, regular and classical, but there was something about it that went beyond beauty, something akin to life, something that seemed to respond to the gaze of the observer and to attract him unconsciously, whether he would or not. The group of discoverers hung over it in a sort of fascination for some minutes, saying nothing. At last Kate, the elder girl, drew back with a slight shiver and said, "Oh, what is it? What is the matter with me? I feel as if there was something wrong. It is too beautiful. I don't like it. Come away, sissy," and she drew her sister out of the chapel in a sort of tremor. Charlie followed them, and Henry was left alone with his gaze still fixed on the lovely face. As he looked, he seemed to read fresh meaning in the cold alabaster features. The mouth, though perfectly composed and rest, appeared to express a certain covert satire. The eyes were represented as open, and they seemed to regard him with a sort of amused curiosity. There was a kind of diablerie about the whole figure. It was a long time before he could remove his eyes from the face that seemed to understand and return his gaze, and it was not without a wrench that at last he turned away. The features of the image seemed to be burned into his brain and to remain fixed there, indelibly. Whether pleasurably or not, he could not decide, for mixed with a strange attraction and even fascination, he was conscious of an undercurrent of terror, and even of aversion, as of something unclean. As he moved away, his eyes caught an inscription in Gothic lettering around the edge of the slab on which the figure lay. "Hic jacet Eleonora, comitissa peccatrix, av obit anno dini, civis animi me sireva." He copied the epitaph in his notebook, remarking that it differed from the usual formula, and then closing the door of the chantry, he followed his cousins back to the house. "Well, here you are at last," said Lady Wilmot as Charlie and his sisters emerged on the lawn. "What a time you have been in the ruins, and the tea is getting cold. And what have you done with Harry?" "Oh, mother," cried Sissy, "we have had such an adventure. You know that little chantry chapel we are so fond of? Well, we thought it wanted tidying up, and so we cleared away the weeds and rubbish. And what do you think we found? Why, the most lovely statue you ever saw. And we left Harry looking at it as if he had fallen in love with it and could not tear himself away." "By Jove," said Charlie, "just like old Pygmalion, who fell in love with the statue and got Venus to bring it to life for him." "Don't talk so, Charlie," said Kate. "I'm sure I don't want this stone lady to come back to life. There is something uncanny about her. I can't describe what, but I was very glad to get away from her." "Yes, mother," said Sissy. "Kate was quite frightened of the stone lady, and dragged me away just as I was longing to look at her, for you never saw anything so lovely in your life." "But there is one thing I noticed, father," said Charlie, "that I think wants looking to, I noticed a bad crack in that fine vault over the chantry, which looks dangerous, and I think Parsons should be sent to have a look at it. Thank you, Charlie, said Sir Thomas. I should be sorry if anything happened to that part of the building, for archaeologists tell me it's the most perfect thing of its kind in England. Parsons is busy on other matters for the next few days, but I will have it seen to next week. By the way, we shall have another visitor tonight. You remember Harry's college friend, Mr. Edwards? I heard he was staying at the Johnstons, and so I asked him to come here for a few days while Harry is with us, and here, I think, he comes across the lawn. Edwards had some previous acquaintance with the Mohamots, and was soon set down to tea with the rest, and engaged for lawn tennis afterwards, a game in which he had earned a great reputation. Harry Charlton did not appear till the party were assembled in the drawing room before dinner. On leaving the abbey, he was possessed by a disinclination for the lively society on the lawn. His nerves were in a strange flutter. He felt as if something unusual was impending, as if he had passed the barrier and shut the gate behind him, and had entered on a new life where strange experiences awaited him. He could not account for it. He tried to dismiss the finding of the statues a mere antiquarian discovery, interesting both in its history and in art, but it would not do. That face, with its enigmatical expression, haunted him, and would not be dismissed. He felt that this was not the end of the adventure, that in some mysterious way the dead woman of 5 centuries back had touched his life, and that more would come of it. To that something more he looked forward with the same indefinable mixture of attraction and repulsion which he had felt in the chapel while gazing at those pure alabaster features. He must be alone. He could not be at present come back to the converse of ordinary life, and he set off on a swinging walk through field and woodland to try and steady his nerves so as to meet his friends in the evening with composure. A good 10-mile stretch did something to restore him to his usual spirits. He was pleased to find his friend Edwards, of whose coming he had not been told, and when he took his place at the dinner table next to his aunt, there was nothing unusual in his manner. The conversation during dinner naturally turned on the discovery that had been made in the abbey that afternoon. It was singular that so remarkable a work of art should have been forgotten and been overlooked by the Northamptonshire Archaeological Society, which had so many enthusiastic antiquaries in its ranks. There had been meetings of the society in the ruins. Papers about them had been read and published. Plans had been made and illustrations drawn of various parts of the building, including the chantry itself. But there was no mention or indication given of the monument, either in the text or in the plates. Strange that no one should have ever thought of looking into that tangle of brambles by which it was concealed till that very day. "I must go first thing tomorrow," said Sir Thomas, "to see your wonderful discovery. The next thing will be to find out who this pretty lady was." "That I think I can tell you, sir," said Henry, who now spoke for almost the first time, "and I think it helps to solve the mystery of the sinful countess in the painted windows opposite, which puzzled us last night." All eyes were turned to the fragments of painted glass in the hall windows as Henry continued. "You see, in the first window, the devil is tempting the Countess Ali, the rest of her name being lost. Well, on the tomb is Epitaph, which gives us the missing part. She is the Countess Eleonora. No further title is given. But whoever she was, the lady whose tomb we found is the same, no doubt, as the lady whose adventures were depicted in the windows." "Now I know," broke in Kate. "Why, I was so frightened in the chapel. She was a wicked woman, and something told me so, and made me want to go away from her." "Well," said Lady Wilmot, "let us hope she mended her ways and ended her life well. You see, she went to Rome and was absolved by the Pope." "Yes, but I bet she did not get absolution for nothing," said Charlie. "Just look at her in the last picture, and you will see she has a church in her hand. Depend on it, she got her wicked deeds pardoned in return for her gifts to Rosemount Abbey. And I dare say she rebuilt a great part of it, and among the rest of her own chantry." "Charlie," said Edwards, "you ought to be a lawyer. You make out such a good case for the prosecution." "At all events," said Sir Thomas, "Charlie gives us a good lead for our research. I will look out the old deeds and try to find what connection, if any, there was between Rosemount Abbey and a Countess Eleonora of some place unknown." The rest of the evening passed in the usual way. A few friends from neighboring houses joined the party. There was a little impromptu dancing. It was near midnight by the time they retired to rest. Henry had enjoyed himself like the rest, and forgot the adventure of the afternoon, till he found himself once more alone in the monastic cell, looking out on the ruined abbey. The recollection of his dream of the night before then for the first time recurred to him. He wondered whether it had any connection with his later experience in the chantry, but he could trace none whatever. The dream seemed merely one of those fanciful imaginings with which we are all familiar, devoid of any further meaning. He was not, however, destined to repose quietly. This time, his dream showed him the same monk. He recognized him by his coarse features and shaggy brows, but he was in the nave of a church, and in the massive round pillars and severe architecture of the arches and triforium, Henry knew the nave of Rosemount Abbey, not as now in ruins, but vaulted and entire. It was nearly dark, and the choir behind the pulpitum was wrapped in gloom, in the midst of which twinkled a few lights, before the high altar and the various saintly shrines. The monk held something small in his hand, was evidently, as on the night before, waiting for somebody or something. At last Henry was aware that somebody had indeed come. A shadowy figure draped in black moved swiftly out from behind a pillar and approached the monk. What the figure was he tried in vain to discover. All he could see was that just as had happened on the night before, a hand was stretched out and took something from the monk, which it promptly hid in the drapery with which the figure was covered. The hand, however, was more clearly seen this time. It was a woman's hand, white and delicate, and a jewel sparkled on her finger. The scene caused Henry a dull terror, as of some unknown calamity, or as of some crime that he had witnessed, and he woke with a start and found himself in a cold sweat. He got up and paced his apartment to and fro, and then looked out of the window. It was brilliant moonlight, and throwing strong shadows of the broken walls across the quiet cloister garth, where the monks of old lay, quietly sleeping till the last red summons should wake them. The light fell full on the ancient nave walls, where buttress and buttress alternately seemed framed of ebon and ivory, and the light touch of the magic of mystery, the delicate tracery of the chantry where lay the Countess Eleonora. Her face flashed upon his memory, with its enigmatical expression, half attracting, half repelling, and an irresistible desire impelled him to see her again. His window was open in the ground only a few feet below. He dressed himself hastily and clambered out. Everything was still. All nature seemed to sleep. Not a breath of wind moved the trees, or stirred the grass as he slowly passed along the cloister. His mind was in a strange state of nervous excitement. He was almost in a trance as he advanced into the nave, where the shadow of column and arch fell back on the broken pavement. He paused a moment at the gate which led into the chantry, and then entered as if in a dream, for everything seemed to him unreal, and he himself a mere phantom. At last he stood beside the tomb and looked down on the lovely countenance which had bewitched him in the afternoon. The moonlight fell upon it, investing it with an unearthly mystery and charm. Its beauty was indescribable. Never had he conceived anything so lovely. The strange, semi-satirical expression of which he had been conscious in the afternoon had disappeared. Nothing could be read in the features but sweetness and allurement. A passionate impulse seized him, and he bent down and kissed her on the lips. Was it fancy, or was it real? That soft lips of warm life seemed to meet his own. He knew not. A delirious ecstasy transported him. The scene faded before his eyes, and he sank on the floor in a swoon. How long he lay there he never knew. When he came to himself, the moon had set, and he was in darkness. An indefinable terror seized him. He struggled to his feet, burst out of the abbey, fled to his rooms, scrambling in through the window, and threw himself panting on his bed. Henry Charlton was the last to appear next morning at the breakfast table. He was pale and out of spirits, and roused himself with difficulty to take part in the discussion as to what was to be done that day. After breakfast he pleaded a headache and retired with a book to the library, while the others betook themselves to various amusements or employments. The girls were in the garden, where they found old Donald the gardener, whose life had been spent at Rosemount, and whose eyes the garden was as much his as his master's, and perhaps more so. "Yes, Missy," he was saying, "the weeds do grow terrible this fine weather, and as you was saying, it is time we cleaned up a bit in the old abbey. But I see the young gentleman has been doing a bit themselves, chucking all them briars and rubbish out on the grass, just as I had mown and tidied it." "Why, Donald," said Sissy, "you ought to have thanked them, for that chapel was in an awful mess, and they have saved you some trouble." "Well, miss, I suppose they pleased theirselves, but that's not where I should have meddled. No, no," and so saying, he moved away. "But why not there?" said Kate. "Why not there of all places?" "Oh, I say nothing about it," said Donald. "Only folk do say that there's them that don't like to be disturbed." "Indeed. What do they say in the village about it?" "Oh, I say nothing. I don't meddle with things above me, and I shan't tell you any more, miss. It's not good for young women to know." "But do you know, Donald," said Sissy, "what we found there?" "What did you find, miss?" "Not her. Oh, Lord. She was found once before, and no good come for it. There, don't ask me any more about it. It's not good for young women to know." So saying, Donald wheeled his barrow away into another part of the garden. "Father," said Kate to Sir Thomas, who now came up, "Donald knows all about the tomb and the statue, and he won't tell us anything, except that the people think it unlucky to meddle with it. Have you ever heard of any superstition about it?" "Nothing at all," said he. "I have just been down to look at your discovery. The statue is a wonderful piece of work. I have never seen anything finer, either here or in Italy. But the chapel is in a bad way, and part of the roof threatens to fall. I have just sent word to Parsons to come tomorrow morning and attend to it." They were joined presently by Edwards and Charlie, and the day passed pleasantly enough, with the usual amusements of a country house and holiday time. Henry did not take part much with them. He was abstracted and inattentive and altogether out of spirits. He had but a confused idea of what had happened the previous night, but there seemed still to linger on his lips that mystic, perhaps unhallowed kiss, and there still floated before his eyes the mocking enigma of that lovely countenance. He dreaded the approach of night, not knowing what it might bring, and did his best to divert his mind to other things, but without much success. His friend Edward was much concerned at the change in his behavior, and asked Charlie whether Henry had been upset in any way during his visit. He was assured that till yesterday afternoon, Henry had been as happy and companionable as possible, and it was only that morning that the change had come over him. "But I can tell you one thing," said Charlie. "I believe he was out of his room last night, for the flower beds show footmarks, and the creepers are torn outside his window, showing someone had been getting in and out, and there certainly has been no burglary in the house. Do you know whether he walks in his sleep?" "I've never heard that he does," said Edwards. "We can't very well ask him whether anything is wrong, for he does not seem to invite inquiry, and has rather avoided us all day. But if it is a case of sleepwalking, we might perhaps keep a lookout tonight to prevent his coming to mischief." "All right," said Charlie. "My room is over his and looks out the same way. I'll try and keep awake till midnight, and will call you if I see anything of him." "That's well," said Edwards, "but we must be careful and not be seen, for it is dangerous to wake a somnambulist, I believe." And so they departed to their several chambers. The first part of the night passed peacefully enough with Henry. He had no dreams to trouble him, but towards midnight he began to turn uneasily in his bed, and to be oppressed by an uneasy feeling that he was not alone. He awoke to find the moon shining as brilliantly as on the previous night, and bringing into view every detail of the ancient building opposite. A dull sense of some sinister influence weighed upon him, someone with whom he could not see, whispering in his ear, "You are mine. You are mine." He could see no form, but to his mental vision was clearly visible the countenance of the figure in the chapel, now with a satirical mocking expression, more fully shown, and he felt himself drawn on he knew not whither. Again the mocking lips seemed to say, "You're mine. You're mine." Half unconsciously he rose from his bed and advanced toward the window. A faintly visible form seemed to move before him. He saw the features of the countess more plainly, and without knowing how he got there, he found himself outside the room in the cloister garth, and entering the shade of the cloister. Something impalpable glided on before him, turning on him the face that attracted him, though it mocked him, and which he could not but follow, though with an increasing feeling of terror and dislike. Still in his ears fell the words, "You are mine. You are mine." And he was helpless to resist the spell that drew him on and on further into the gloom of the ruined nave. And now the shape gathered consistency, and he seemed to see the Countess Eleonora standing facing him. On her features, the same mocking smile, on her finger, the jewel of his dream. "You are mine," she seemed to say. "Mine, mine. You sealed it with a kiss," and she outstretched her arms. But as she stood before him in her marvelous and unearthly beauty, a change came over her. Her face sank into ghastly furrows, her limbs shriveled, and as she advanced upon him, a mouth of loathly corruption, and stretched out her horrible arms to embrace him, he uttered a dreadful scream as of a soul in torture, and sank fainting on the ground. "Edwards, Edwards, come quick," cried Charlie, beating at his door. "Harry is out of his room, and there's something with him. I don't know what it is, but hurry up, or some mischief may happen." His friend was ready in a moment, and the two crept cautiously downstairs, and, as the readiest way not to disturb the household, got out onto the cloister through the window of Harry's room. They noticed on the way that his bed had been slept in, and was tossed about in disorder. They took the way of the cloister by which Charlie had seen Harry go, and had just reached the door that led to the nave when his unearthly scream of terror fell on the ears. They rushed into the church, crying, "Harry, Harry, here we are! What is it? Where are you?" And having no reply, they searched as well as they could in the moonlight. They found him at last stretched on the ground at the entrance to the fatal Chantry Chapel. At first they thought he was dead, but his pulse beat faintly, and they carried him out, still insensible, into the outer air. He showed some signs of life, before long, but remained unconscious. The house was roused, and he was put to bed, and messengers were sent for the doctor. As they watched by his bedside, a thundering crash startled them. Looking out of the window, they saw a cloud of dust where the chantry had been, and next morning it was seen that the roof had fallen in and destroyed it. Harry Charlton lay many weeks with a brain fever. From his cries and ravings, something was gathered of the horrors of that fatal night, but he would ne'er be induced to tell the whole story after he recovered. The fallen ruin was removed, and Sir Thomas hoped that the beautiful statue might have escaped. But strange to say, though every fragment of masonry was carefully examined and accounted for, no trace could be found of any alabaster figure, nor of the tomb of the Comtesse Eleonora.